is VOA News via remote. I'm Diane Roberts. The number of COVID-19 infections has surpassed another grim milestone, infecting more than 10 million people, 2.5 million of them in the United States. Nearly 500,000 people have died from COVID-19, more than 125,000 in the United States. For many states in the U.S., the dark days of the coronavirus pandemic in April unfolded on their television screens, not on their doorsteps. Now, some places that appear to have avoided the worst are seeing surges of infections. There are concerns the United States is entering a dangerous new phase, with many southern states reporting thousands of new cases a day. Excuse me. And after weeks of anxiously waiting and preparing, nurses and doctors in the western state of Arizona find themselves on the front line as the coronavirus rips through the state. It's one of the world's newest coronavirus hotspots. The Brazilian government has announced an agreement with Oxford University and pharmaceutical company AstraZeneca to produce a promising coronavirus vaccine that is undergoing tests. Brazilian health ministry authorities said Saturday the country will pay $127 million and receive material to produce 30.4 million doses in two batches in December and January, which would allow it to quickly start inoculation efforts if the vaccine is certified to be safe and effective. The total deal is for 100 million vaccines for a country of about 210 million people. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani said wearing of masks will become mandatory for 2 weeks starting next Sunday in gathering places that are deemed red spots. Iran launched a campaign Saturday to motivate a reluctant public to use face masks. Sunday, Rouhani said his country is experiencing its toughest year because of the COVID-19 pandemic, coupled with U.S. sanctions. This is VOA News. A controversial and racially charged video retweeted by U.S. President Donald Trump has been taken down just hours after he sent it. The video contains a white power message at a retirement facility in Florida during a pro-Trump rally. Prior to the video's removal, U.S. Senator Tim Scott, the only black Republican in the Senate, said President Trump's retweet was offensive and should be removed from Twitter. Scott told CNN, quote, "There's no question that he should not have retweeted it, and he should just take it down," adding, "it's indefensible," end quote. The controversy comes as the nation and world tackle the heavy issues of racial inequality and police reform following the deaths of several African Americans while in police custody. The White House denies U.S. President Donald Trump was briefed on a reported finding that Russian military intelligence offered bounties to Taliban-linked militants to kill U.S. troops in Afghanistan. Today, Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives Nancy Pelosi tells ABC News that the president's denial, quote, "shows he wants to ignore any allegations against Russia," end quote. White House Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany said in a statement, neither Mr. Trump nor Vice President Mike Pence was briefed on the alleged Russian bounty intelligence. A U.S. newspaper, The New York Times, reported U.S. intelligence officials concluded months ago that Russian military intelligence offered the bounties to Taliban-linked militants. An organization that monitors war says airstrikes targeting positions of Iran-backed militias in eastern Syria killed 9 fighters Sunday in the second such raid in 24 hours. The Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said Israel was, quote, "likely responsible," end quote, for the strikes near the Iraqi border. They came hours after a similar raid killed 6 other Tehran-backed fighters, raising the total toll to 15 killed in 24 hours, according to the organization. There was no official comment from Israel. Algeria's defense ministry said Sunday 2 Algerian soldiers, including an officer, were killed when a bomb exploded during an army operation in the north of the country. The 2 were killed Saturday night, the ministry said in a statement, after a homemade bomb exploded during a search and sweep operation in the province of Mahdia, south of the capital, Algiers. The deaths bring the total number of Algerian soldiers killed this year to 4. Iceland's president, Guðni Johansson, has been reelected with a whopping 92% of the vote, according to final results released Sunday. The former history professor won his second 4-year term in the largely symbolic position in Saturday's vote, the second election held by a European country after coronavirus lockdowns were lifted. It's the second highest margin of victory in the history of Iceland's presidential elections. By remote, Diane Roberts, VOA News.
good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
Elections have, in the time past, including now, divided the nation through tribalism and things like that. We should now reunite the country. That's number one. Number two, he should be a man of his word. So the things that he has said he will do, he must be seen to be doing them.
Dr. Lazarus Chakwera is installed as the new president of Malawi Sunday.
We should not have suppressed our representation. This is very important. It's not only diplomatically, it's a matter of development. How can you kill your development where you want to develop yourself?
Groups petition Benin President Patrice Talon to stop plans to only keep 10 embassies around the world.
Whether the citizens are being treated fairly or they are being shortchanged, I think that currently we citizens are being shortchanged, and it is the onus lies on the government to ensure that we are being treated fairly.
And a hospital in Ghana comes under sharp criticisms over allegations of medical malpractice. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Malawi, the Public Affairs Committee, an interreligious group, is calling on the newly installed president, Dr. Lazarus Chakwera, and his team to keep the promises they made to Malawians to create jobs and improve their living conditions. Campaigning ahead of the recent poll rerun, the newly elected government promised to create 1 million jobs in the first year and embark on policies to protect the public purse by implementing measures to stop corruption. The remarks come following the official swearing-in of President Chakwera and his vice president, Dr. Salos Chilima, at a ceremony in the capital Lilongwe Sunday. Bishop Guilford Matunga, spokesperson for the Public Affairs Committee, says the outcome of the presidential poll rerun was transparent and credible. He tells me that it will be prudent for the new president and his team to choose leaders who will put the needs of Malawians first.
Yes, the Public Affairs Committee has been engaging these politicians during the electoral process. But now that the election is finally over and we have a winner in the name of Dr. Lazarus Chakwera, so we are appealing to Dr. Chakwera and Dr. Chilima that now that they have gotten into government, it is important that they should not shortchange Malawians. They should make sure that they fulfill every promise they have made. They have promised to reduce the cost of fertilizer. They have said that they are going to assist Malawians to have jobs, about 1 million jobs in the first year of their rule.
Now, Bishop Matunga, but there are concerns too that usually when politicians campaign, the reality sets in when they are handed over power, the challenges and the difficulties sometimes prove difficult for them to keep the promises they made. Are these factored in with your reminder or PAC's reminder of the leadership to keep its promises to provide the 1 million jobs in the first year of its existence when elected, as it has happened now?
When they were making promises, they should have been aware of the current situation in the country. They should have been aware of the challenges like the ones that you're mentioning. By the way, the vice president now was also vice president in the past government. That means that he is very much aware of what government is capable of raising as resources in order to bring development in this country. So when they were making these promises, they were pretty aware of where they were going to get the money from, and they knew what they were going to do in order to respond to the issues that Malawians are going through at the moment.
Bishop Matunga, I also understand there's a suggestion that the new leadership of Dr. Lazarus Chakwera, the new president, and Vice President Dr. Salos Chilima, the former vice president who is now the vice president again, should appoint leaders that will put the needs of the people first in order to carry out its mandate to protect the people and create the jobs that they need. What is your take on this?
Actually, they have campaigned on that very pretext, that they are not going to put self-interest or indeed issues that have to do with their own betterment or enrichment, but they are there to save the country of Malawi and the poor people out there. We have already seen that they are capable of doing that because they have won as an alliance. They had to sacrifice as the certain positions and certain things in order for them to work together. So we believe that the same spirit of wanting to save Malawi and wanting to deliver to the people of Malawi, which made them come into an alliance, is going to motivate them to work together and save the common man. Because if they don't, Malawians will actually vote them out because Malawians are not ready to be deceived again.
As you know, Bishop Matonga, the former president and his DPP party have expressed concern about the outcome of the election. They are disputing it, citing voter irregularities, intimidation and harassment of his supporters. Now, what is your reaction to that, in spite of the fact that probably they might go to court to challenge the outcome of the election? Do you see any success of their challenge if they indeed they go to court?
I don't really see that they will succeed because for the first time, I would say, in Malawi, we have observed that the Electoral Commission has been so transparent in the way they have handled this election. Right from the time that people were voting, we believe that DPP was represented at every polling station. And we believe that the whole process of voter counting and tabulation of votes, that everything was being done in a very transparent manner. The whole process was transparent. That is not only the view of Public Affairs Committee, but also for the other independent observers that were there. But DPP has a right to go to court. We encourage them to do so. It is up to the courts to overrule.
Before you go, Bishop Matonga, you are a reverend minister. The new president is also a reverend minister. What advice would you give him in his new capacity as the president of Malawi, duly inaugurated on Sunday?
We ask the president to be accommodating, just like they have been saying on the political podium during the campaign. He is now a president of a nation, not president of a political party. He has to embrace every Malawian. He even has to embrace the people that he has ousted out of power at the moment. So we ask our reverend brother, who is now His Excellency, the President, Dr. Chakwera. He is experienced in that manner, and that's what we ask him to do. He's got to unify the country. The regions. The elections have, in the time past, including now, divided the nation through tribalism and things like that. We should now reunite the country. That's number one. Number two, he should be a man of his word. So the things that he has said he will do, he must be seen to be doing them.
Bishop Guilford Matonga is the spokesperson for the Public Affairs Committee. He spoke with me from the Malawian capital, Lilongwe. In Benin, the government is coming under criticism for planning to close down a significant number of diplomatic missions abroad. Announcing the decision, the foreign minister said the country will maintain selected diplomatic missions on all the continents. Beginning August 1, the country would have only 10 embassies and consulates around the world. There will only be two in Africa, the embassies in Nigeria and Morocco. But former envoys, opposition and civil society groups in Benin have petitioned President Patrice Talon to change course. The decision to close down the embassies, they argue, will diminish the country's potential and its relevance on the international stage. Attorney Sadiku Alao, president of the African Center for Strategic Studies in Benin, was a signatory to the petition. He tells me the government is making a grave mistake by closing down the embassies.
I think this letter was written to the president because we all globally, a majority of the people of our country, we think that closing 3/4 of our representation abroad, including the representation at the UN, at the African Union, at the European Union, as well as UNESCO, is a way of ignoring the history of our country and the objective and the aiming of our country, because the country has the people of the Benin all over the world, And even today, it's difficult for them to have a passport. How can we ignore the representation at the United Nations where a country like Benin is born? I think it's a way of killing our country. No country can be run in this way.
Since the letter was presented to the government, have you received any response, and what will you do next?
Since the letter has been written, I think a lot of people are reacting, including some journalists, as well as some diplomats, and they are reacting diplomatically. And they think that the head of state cannot have taken such an important decision without consulting anybody. But apparently, there is nothing anybody could do about it, because, you know, the regime now is a very, very strong and hard dictatorial regime. The regime does not listen to anybody, and is the one man taking the decision, and there's nobody to stop him.
But Sadiko, the president, as you know, is mandated by the constitution, and he has enormous powers to make such decisions. Why do you think this decision is wrong?
The head of state, as head of the executive power, of course, he has a lot of power and he can make a lot of decisions. But this particular one is touching our sovereignty and some fundamental issues of our independence and our sovereignty. You know, when Benin was born, it was born at the United Nations, at the UN. All countries existing in the world and as member of United Nations, they have a representation there. How can you think that a small country like Benin, who wants to be known and to be a touristic country and wants to be recognized as such, is passing from 47 representation in various countries to less than 10? How can you be a recognized nation by three quarter your representation if you want to kill a country, a small country? You will not take a different decision. Is a pity, and the world should pity us.
As you said, Benin is a small country. What do you say to those who are of the opinion that because Benin is small, it needs to cut its size according to its cloth, and that the expenditure is too much to pay for all these expenses, and that is why a decision was taken? So you have a few of these to take care of the entire needs, diplomatic needs of Benin.
Yes, Benin is a small country. But, you know, out of the 100 and probably 170 countries in the world, Benin has simply 47 diplomatic representation, which does not represent 20% of the countries existing in the world. It means that the previous government, since 1972, has been able to maintain those 47 countries. How can you imagine that today, after reducing the number of people in the various representations, we can come to less than 10 countries where we have a representation? But the representations in the multilateral institutions that are vital for the country economically, how can the head of state decide to suppress those that are vital? European Union, UN, African Union, and UNESCO. While the country is talking of expanding and making its culture known all over the world. I think this is a big contradiction. Economically, we need the foreign countries. We need the foreign institutions. We need the multilateralism. And we want to develop our tourism. At least for those four multilateral institutions, we should not have suppressed our representation. This is very important. It's not only diplomatically. It's a matter of development. How can you kill your development where you want to develop yourself?
Attorney Sadiku Alao is the president of the African Center for Strategic Studies. He spoke with me from the Beninese capital, Cotonou. Google has launched a program which will augment the work for nonprofit organizations in Nigeria and Ghana. The program enables the not-for-profit groups to have access to Google products, including G Suite for nonprofits. It helps nonprofit groups to effectively collaborate online. The groups will have access to ad grants. This provides up to $10,000 a month for advertising on Google search, which will be available for 6 months. They would also have access to the YouTube nonprofit program. Frank Sombo leads the West African program TechSoup, which worked with Google to launch the Google for Nonprofits in Nigeria and Ghana. Sombo tells me that through this program, Nigerian and Ghanaian nonprofit groups will be able to get access to a number of Google's paid products, tools, and profit services at no cost.
Just to say, even before the launch of this program, we've been receiving some queries from organizations who were a bit anxious that they needed Google to be available in the region, and they were really expectant. So since the launch, organizations have welcomed it with very high level of enthusiasm, and we have been receiving requests by organizations to some of them to get guidance on how to activate their Google for Nonprofit accounts, and others to come directly to get their token to go and activate their account. And some other countries who are not from those two countries have also been inquiring on when is Google for Nonprofit coming to their country. So there has been a lot of excitement and also and positive actions from organizations in getting their activation done for the Google for Nonprofit opportunity.
So Frank, how beneficial will this have in both Nigeria and Ghana following the launch?
As the name suggests, Google for Nonprofit is a Google program for the nonprofit constituency, and that means that Google has tailored a service which is at no cost and highly beneficial for organizations. It gives them a suite of applications, including for email, for YouTube for nonprofit, and then Google advertisement grants. So organizations have up to $10,000 of grants for monthly advertisement. And also they have Google Ads that help them to kind of showcase their work in different places that they are having their programs and several other opportunities. So Google for Nonprofit is a one-stop shop opportunity for nonprofit sector at no cost to organizations, and showcasing their work to attract donors and to demonstrate the value of their social impact.
So what has been the responses of these nonprofits following the launch? Have you seen a surge in their registration or trying to take advantage of this offer by Google?
Yes, we can tell you from where we sit that since we started with this donation, as of yesterday when we looked at our registration rate, we had about four times the rate of registration that we had recorded for the month of January, and about at least close to three times the registration volume that we got for the month of May. So that tells you how much the volume or the traction we are getting since the launch of the Google for Nonprofit. But of course, many of us are getting to hear about it, and we are hoping that it will even increase further when we expand the visibility and the information across the country that we are talking about, Ghana and Nigeria.
When do you plan on expanding the availability of the products that you just talked about?
So the decision on which country do benefit from it lies within the discretion, or let's say the prerogative of Google. And so we are only glad that at least it has started in the region with those two countries. So we are hoping that the next step of the Google implementation roadmap will have more countries, and especially other Francophone and also Anglophone countries in West Africa. So for now, we'll get started with those two and try as much as possible to intensify the reach and maximize visibility so that the program gets successful and it also benefits other countries that we are serving as. So yes, we are most hopeful that very soon it will expand to other countries.
Talking about visibility, what is the target, or perhaps the objective, or the number of organizations that you are targeting?
I've already mentioned that we have quadrupled, and to some extent, some of our registration and monthly registration. But basically, we are looking at the highest number possible of organizations. We are yet to kind of put figures working with the team, both from TechSoup, from Google, and internally. So, yes, we have a roadmap that will be kind of laid out and will give us more ideas as to how much. But when you look at the civil society constituency in West Africa, it's both in Ghana and Nigeria, we have quite a high number of organizations that are operating, and we believe that it should benefit as much organization as possible within the region. And that is like in the hundreds, if not in the thousands of organizations within the region.
Frank Sombo leads the West African program TechSoup, which worked with Google to launch the Google for Nonprofits in Nigeria and Ghana. He spoke with me from the Ghanaian capital, Accra. In Ghana, the authorities at the Greater Accra Regional Hospital has launched an investigation into the death of a patient allegedly due to medical negligence. Narrating an experience at the hospital in the capital, Accra, Dr. Emmanuel Kutu, director at the Ghana Institute of Languages, detailed the circumstances that led to his wife's death. Kutu's post suggests it was the second time that the same doctor prescribed the wrong medication for another patient for which he was reprimanded. Kutu's social media posting has since gone viral and is generating sharp criticism of the hospital and its staff. Dr. Emmanuel Kutu tells me that he is still in shock at how his late wife was treated at the Greater Accra Regional Hospital.
Yes, my wife turned up for surgery on Sunday and had surgery on Monday. She was quite well on Monday, and she suddenly became worse off, very, very worse off. And turned out when the doctor came that he said one of the medications that had been administered to her was not what he had prescribed her, but she had been given the wrong medication. And he inquired from the nurses. He was told that his other colleagues had come around to prescribe that medication. I was with them as they discussed it, and he took the phone and called the other doctor who had prescribed it, and he not just had admitted that yes, he had prescribed that medication that was given to my wife. So briefly, that led to the medications that eventually ended the life of my wife.
So I understand this is not the first time. From the conversation you heard between the two doctors, this is not the first time the doctor has prescribed the same medication to another patient, wrong medication, and that led to that patient's death as well.
I didn't hear specifically that the other patient died. I heard specifically that yes, he had prescribed the same medication to some other person earlier on. He had been reprimanded. I did hear that on the phone being said by the doctor who was treating my wife. Yes.
So what has been the reaction since this message of the experience you had at this specific hospital went viral? Because everybody is talking about it, condemning the circumstances that led to your wife's death.
I myself have been shocked by the reaction. It's like it's a bushfire. It's caught everywhere. Apparently, people have had a lot of bad experiences with the same hospital, and so they had to get it off their chest. You cannot believe the amount, the number of calls that are received. He said, about 12 strangers who have heard of me, and it is the whole of the Ghanaian social media is a war for it. I'm happy that we've been able to create awareness to raise these issues so that the Ministry of Health, the government, and the entire country can sit up and prevent situations where people die for no good cause, die unnecessarily.
Have officials from the hospital approached you about your concerns?
Not at all. Not at all. Nobody has approached me.
Well, some people are urging you to schedule a meeting with the health authorities or perhaps the minister to address this, because as you rightly put it, a lot of Ghanaians have expressed concern that they have been through similar circumstances, yet something appear not to be done to resolve this concern. What is your stance on that?
It's an idea to be considered, but honestly, my priority now is to take care of my family, that I've done something considerable by bringing attention, the cultural attention of the country. I could consider that option, but I want to wait and consider all my options first, and then I'll see what we'll do.
I understand on social media platforms, a lot of people are calling for you to sue the hospital and to seek legal redress because of this circumstances. Are you thinking about this, or what redress do you seek about it?
Yes, I have indeed received so many calls urging me to sue the hospital. But here is the case. I'm not sure that I am able to provide the critical proof evidence that will require to win a case case against the hospital. At the time that the matter was going on, I wasn't recording, and it's more or less my word against their word. But that's not the point. The point is that I and my family have been traumatized by this event, and would rather prefer to draw and stay at home so that I can concentrate on my children, and I'm not really known to be dragged into prolonged legal battles. I think I want to go on with my life.
Are you surprised about the reaction you've gotten so far after you know came up with this message about your experience at the hospital?
Surprise is an understatement. I am overwhelmed. I am shocked. Received hundreds of calls, literally, people calling in, total strangers to encourage me, to sympathize and empathize with me. The whole story is I watched the social media in Ghana. I watched the story. It's like a bushfire burning. I'm shocked, but in a pleasant way. And I'm hoping that this is the beginning, this is the momentum for us to change the way things are done in our hospitals, because just too many people are dying needlessly in Ghanaian hospitals.
So what is your message to the people of Ghana, as well as the authorities who are in charge of ensuring that the proper things are done?
Well, to Ghanaians, I say that it is about time we took our lives in our own hands, ensure vigilance when we go to hospitals, and also ensure demand accountability from doctors. As to the authorities, they are the appointing authorities at the hospital, but I think that they should be paying closer look at what the money they are pumping. The Ghanaian government pumps so much money into hospitals. I think it is fully fair that they pay a close attention to see whether we are getting value for money, whether the citizens are being treated fairly or they are being shortchanged. I think that currently we citizens are being shortchanged, and the onus lies on the government to ensure that we are being treated fairly.
Dr. Emmanuel Kuto is the director at the Ghana Institute of Languages. He spoke with me from the capital, Accra. And this is The Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Douglas Impuga, and music from our African collection. But first, humanitarian groups are expressing concern that the invasion of locusts in the East African region and the coronavirus are having a devastating effect in the region. Kirk Pritchard, Vice President of Humanitarian Programs for Concern Worldwide, says the combination of locusts and coronavirus will continue to decimate already needy areas and livelihoods, adding to greater food insecurity and loss. This after the humanitarian group said the desert locust situation has worsened in parts of the East African region. Kirk Pritchard tells me that the limited financial resources of each country makes it difficult to fight the locusts. He also says imposed curfews and movement restrictions to curb the spread of the coronavirus also limits people's ability to travel for food or work.
Yes, the locusts are actually devastating the agriculture and economic impact, livelihoods of many of the people that CONCERN works with in East Africa. We're talking massive crop losses for certain people and just all-around devastation in numerous countries, including Kenya, Ethiopia, parts of South Sudan, moving into Somalia, which is particularly worrisome given the nutritional and food security status there, and all over essentially the entire Horn of Africa. This is a region that was having issues beforehand with food security, and this is obviously not going to help anything. This is the worst desert locust outbreak Kenya's seen in over 70 years, and it couldn't come at a worse time.
So talk to me about why it's so difficult to address this issue of this locust in East Africa, particularly when it comes to countries having the financial means to combat the havoc that these locusts cause in that part of Africa.
Yeah, and then there's a two or more part answer to that question. On the macro level, there is no easy, simple, and affordable solution to the desert locust. I mean, there's crop spraying and other things that are effective to some extent, but there's not a low-cost solution to this. It's not like making water potable by just adding a pill to it. You know, there is no way to quickly and simply treat the desert locust outbreak, and it can affect such a large area that it really, you know, stretches the limits of any government, regardless of where it would be, and especially in some of these countries that CONCERN works. But then it also goes down into the micro level or the local level as well. In many of the communities that this is affecting, there's not a large safety net, and people do not have massive amounts of assets to fall back on if something happens. They live season to season, you know, crop to crop. There's often a hunger season or a hunger gap in between this as is. So there's no safety net to catch people if a crop fails, you know. So you're talking about then people resorting to negative coping mechanisms, having to sell assets, having to do other things that are really not good for their long-term health or well-being. So it's a micro and a macro problem that affects the region.
Kirk, why is it difficult that these governments in the East African region have found it difficult to mobilize themselves resources, right? Because I understand some of them deployed the military, deployed some other tactics like in Uganda to try to resolve it. Why has it been so difficult to resolve this?
A lot of it's the scale, honestly. These are the biggest swarms we've seen in decades, as I was saying. And it isn't something that happens every year as well. So it's unprecedented. People were not particularly expecting this to happen. So like anything else that catches people by surprise, it's more difficult. You add on to that everything that's happening with the coronavirus and COVID-19 and both the world's attention on that, the lack of resources, the lack of institutional or multilateral donors jumping in, and even things like the restriction on travel. I was reading one story about how one of the big pesticides that's used to treat this or insecticides to treat this is coming from India, and that needs Indian pilots to do some of the work around this. But however, if you have a limit or a ban on people coming into the country, they have to sit in quarantine. It took 14 more days, et cetera, you know, very much limiting that response. So it's a variety of reasons behind it, none of which are easily solved.
You talked about curfews. Some people have expressed concern that curfews imposed movement restriction imposed by government in the region, you know, to stop the spread of the coronavirus or to limit the spread of the disease, also limits the ability of people or citizens in the respective countries to travel for food or work. Talk to me about this scenario.
Yeah, it goes back to that coping mechanism as well, and it's taking away one of the primary means that very rural or agriculture-based communities would have used in the past to survive. It is simply impossible for many people to move to a city or a larger town or something to work in the informal economy. And it's twofold. It is the curfew to some extent, but it's also just the complete lack of economic activities due to COVID and the things that go along with that. If you're essentially shutting down the informal economy in these areas, then there is no labor opportunities, even if people were able to move into the cities or whatnot. So it's both the curfew and the economic fallout. And it actually goes a lot bigger than that. The economic fallout from COVID and coronavirus is devastating the countries and the economies and the nutritional status for the world at large. And the locusts are only compounding that. So you have a perfect storm, for lack of a better phrase, of difficulty in the region and globally, to be honest.
Kirk Pritchard is the Vice President of Humanitarian Programs for Concern Worldwide. He spoke with me from New Jersey. Zimbabwean schools have been exploring new ways to keep their calendars as intact as possible amid COVID-19 disruptions. The country has rolled out e-learning, televised lessons, and radio programs, but they haven't been completely welcome. For VOA Kutsai's Vainavashi reports from the Zimbabwean capital, Harare.
Nyaradzo Mashayamombe is the executive director of a non-profit called Tege Life International. She is the convener of the Every Child in School campaign, together with other organizations.
A campaign which launched in 2017 and was asking the government of Zimbabwe to cater for poor children, to make sure that every child has access to education. This was at a backdrop of the fact that more than 27% of children were out of school, according to government statistics.
Mashayamombe says their lobbying has met some success, following government's promise to make education accessible to all children. She says COVID-19 outbreak has created a new set of challenges.
Just as we were about to push to make sure that every child is in school according to the campaign and asking government to actually now implement its promises, COVID-19 happened, which removed every child out of school.
Radio lessons are being rolled out and television lessons may soon follow. But Mashayamombe says learners will be left out.
We know that right now in Zimbabwe, not every household owns a radio, not every household owns a television. And we know that Group A schools, they didn't really stop education because it's been going on online. But majority of our learners, probably more than 80%, do not have that kind of privilege.
As a result, she says they have since petitioned Parliament to hold government accountable and roll out an inclusive education. Mashaya Mombe says there is need to establish a system like in a classroom where there is give and take between student and teacher, along with a way to evaluate how many students are actually benefiting from the radio lessons and a huge uptake of technology, which can ensure inclusivity. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zhinavashe from Harare.
It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. England's Liverpool have won the Premier League, the first time they have triumphed in the top flight since 1990, and their first time ever since the Premier League began. It's been a great season for Liverpool. They are now Premier League champions, European champions, and World Club Cup champions. The club was powered in part by crucial players from Africa, such as Egyptian striker Mo Salah, Senegalese Sadio Mane, Guinean Naby Keita, Cameroonian Joel Matip, and David Origi. Although Origi plays for Belgium, his father Mike was a Kenyan international, so he makes the list anyway. Still in football, Australia and New Zealand have been selected to host the FIFA Women's World Cup 2023. A vote taken by FIFA Council was announced by FIFA President Gianni Infantino. The joint bid by Football Federation Australia and New Zealand Football Association beat Colombia Football Association's bid by 13 points. The FIFA Women's World Cup 2023 will be the first edition to feature 32 teams, and it will also be the first to be hosted by Australia and New Zealand and across two confederations. In athletics, a three-time world half marathon champion Geoffrey Kamworor sustained injuries after he was struck by a motorcycle while on a training run on Thursday morning in Eldoret, Kenya. According to a report in the Daily Nation newspaper, the 27-year-old Kamworor sustained injuries on his head and ankle. The motorist who struck him stopped to help the injured runner. He was planning to defend his New York City Marathon title in November until organizers announced the race cancellation on Wednesday. Meanwhile, organizers of the Sanlam Cape Town Marathon are about to take virtual racing to another level. While the race, its associated half marathon and 10 kilometers and 5 kilometers peace runs have been canceled, they will still be staged virtually on October 18th. And they will still give the runners the look and feel of the South African city, no matter where they plan to run it. A race app will measure the route the runners are running and match it with scenes and sounds from the actual course. When they reach the race 5-kilometer mark, runners will hear crashing waves and the sail pitches of ice cream sellers, which figure prominently on the ocean side. At the 14.1-kilometer point, the site of the town hall where Nelson Mandela first addressed the nation upon release from prison, runners will listen to the Nobel Peace Prize winner's speech. The app includes plenty of social media integration so runners can share their experience, and we also have a real-time leaderboard. The virtual Cape Town Marathon follows the cancellation of the Berlin Marathon. The New York City Marathon was also cancelled earlier due to coronavirus-related health and safety concerns for runners, spectators, volunteers, staff, and the many partners and communities that support the event. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Now back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
Everything all right with you, girl. You deep on my mind like that too. Every night and day, no one but you, girl. All the things what I do for you. Well, I know I'm done about the work. In my heart, there's no one but you. Oh, my girl, you're my baby girl. Go in any country.
see that day I'm on. Love the way that you want it always for me. Señorita, te amo. Love the way that that booty rotates for me. Where the question is, mi amiga. Girl, you know that I love you. Oh, oh, oh. Ika wumpu, kika wungwa. Anything that you want me to, girl, I go do for you. Yes, mi amiga. Girl, I just won't be your friend. Ya por mi na kupenda.
coco. She want know the coco. Yeah. But I want to give you some love. She talks at the coco. She still want know the coco. Yeah.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Mpuga, and producer Saida Hamdoun, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, however little you think of the elephant, you cannot say it won't feel a part. I'm your host, Peter Clotet in Washington. Good evening, Africa.